The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
What day is it? Friday. Friday. All right. That means once a month on the third Friday. It is the third Friday. Admiral Harry Cooper rises from the depths. Rises from the depths to make an appearance here. Now, that's not like Joe Biden rising from his casket every day to be reanimated, injected with various potions, and electronically nanoparticulately re-energized and reanimated. But nonetheless, it is a vertical motion, no matter how you look at it. Welcome back, Admiral Cooper.
Good evening, good evening.
I'll give you an hour to figure that out. I have no idea what I just said. Here.
I don't either.
Here's a spit. I'm going to... You know when they, in the Navy, when they pipe somebody aboard?
Right.
All right. Here's the new way. Here's the new... That's right. No, no. This is the way they do it now. Or will be very shortly. Times are changing.
Children of the night.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now don't talk about children. You're fully respected adult. And after that photo of... Did you see the photo of Biden grabbing the little boy, the five-year-old boy, on both sides of his head and pushing his mouth on his? Now, all right, look.
What a beauty.
Not that either
guy
one
is.
Of us... If anyone else would do that, what would happen?
Would collapse on them. They'd be gone
right.
In a heartbeat.
That's right.
Yeah, I saw on the news tonight that the Catholic
news?
Church is coming down on him.
Who?
Because he says he's a practicing Catholic, but yet he's all in favor of abortion. So a bunch of bishops have come together and said he better stop saying he's a practicing Catholic, or they're considering refusing him Holy Communion.
Well, they should refuse it to let him in the damn building.
I agree.
Not practicing. He'll never get it right, no matter how much practice he puts into it. He's a pervert. He's a pedo pervert. And unfortunately, the truth of the matter is an awful lot of priests in the Catholic Church are also pedo perverts. And that's just
I've
a fact.
I've heard that, sure.
And anyway, maybe they'll let him in on that basis. Okay. I keep looking at these incredible little YouTube mini documentaries, 10 minutes, 12 minutes, 15, about the U-boats in World War II, the German U-boats.
Mm-hmm.
Not the Nazi U-boat, the German Navy's U-boats. All right.
I know.
Now, it just amazes me that Americans are so tragically misinformed. They don't understand that Soviet Russia was a godless horror on this planet, which led to the deaths of approximately a million souls, most of whom were Christians. Americans also don't know that Germany and its people were largely Christian.
Absolutely.
90%. It was a Christian nation, and we fought the wrong enemy. Ask General Patton's relatives. Read Patton's letters. Everybody who has a brain, we fought the wrong, and we got tricked, and we fought the most evil on the planet. No, we fought to defeat the most open-minded Christian group in Europe. And I say that with all advice and consent. The Soviets were the enemy. And I think people are realizing that now. Finally, it's taken a long time.
Yeah, and I, as you know, I was a kid during the war years, and we were told that U-boaters machine gun people in the water for sport and et cetera, et cetera. And it's absolutely not true.
All filthy lies.
They would in the early days, before the ASW effort got so good from the U.S., but in the early days, they'd usually come alongside the lifeboats and make sure anybody who needed medical help, they'd help them. They'd give them water. And I think I said before on your show that one of our members, Captain Peter Chelimedos, was a merchant skipper and got sunk by a U-boat in the North Atlantic. And the U-boat came alongside and was talking to him and asked if anybody needed medical help, and no, nobody did. And so the U-boat skipper gave him a compass and told him what direction to steer to find the closest land, and then said, I'd like to give you some fresh water, but our desalinator is down. Would you take a couple cases of beer instead? So, and many times U-boat skippers and the captains of the ships they sank reunited after the war and became friends. We had quite a few members who were American, either merchant people or Navy on board merchant ships, would find the skipper of the boat that sank them. As a matter of fact, one of them, Captain Vita, captain of U-159, who won the Knight's Cross, his wife's grandfather was Engelbert Humperdinck, the real one, not the moppy-haired singer, but the guy who wrote the the opera Hansel and Gretel.
He's a composer, Hansel and Gretel.
Exactly.
Yeah.
One of the guys who sank him contacted them right after the war, and Germany was in terrible shape. I remember we were sending over care packages. That's what they were called. C-A-R-E meant for some relief of Europe. A Christian American Relief for Europe, yeah. And Captain Vita told this American skipper that his family had no food. So this American skipper, who was also a member, got over 8,000 members, can't remember all the names, but he was sending food over to the guy who sank him years before. They were honorable, decent people.
It's just a sickening state of affairs when you look back at history as it really was, and thanks to Harry and his magnificent heroic efforts with shark hunters, we have a chance to understand the reality of that war. Now, keep in mind also that the crew on these boats were young, sometimes teenagers, young kids, 18, 19, 20, and they were
lining
up. Toward
the end of the war, 16 and 17.
There you go. And it really sickens me to say this, but over 35,000 of these young men went down with their U-boats?
No, 35,000 approximately signed up in the U-Boot-Waffe, and 29,800 and something
never
died.
Came back.
Right, that's correct.
30,000 died.
It was the worst attrition attrition of any military force ever in history. As a comparison, the United States Navy submarine service had the worst attrition rate of the American forces. One man in seven was killed. On the German side, one man in seven came home. 28. And as I point out in the books we write, when we list the names of the men who were killed, these are not just names on a sheet of paper. This is somebody's son who didn't come home. This is somebody's husband, somebody's kid brother that didn't come home. I was in the military. Thank God there was no war going on, and even if there was, I was stationed in the middle of the U.S., commanding a group loading hydrogen bombs onto heavy bombers. But when, in 1984, my 20-year-old son was killed, and there's just no pain that can compare to it. And all these men who didn't come home, not only the German U-boaters, but every young man, every young woman who was killed in a war is not just a name on a sheet of paper. It's a person. It's a person whose mom and dad had plans for them later on. It's a person whose spouse was expecting them home. And it just, you know, breaks my heart to see all this. But assholes, you'll part. I can't say that on your show, sorry. But like the spit lickers, you know, who say that, you know, I'm a Nazi because I tell the story of the German U-boaters, and Shark Hunters is a hate group, even though Ronald Reagan was a member, Senator Al D'Amato was a member, the four Medal of Honor winning American submarine commanders were members, the most highly decorated American submariner ever in history, Admiral Flucky, sat on my sofa here some years ago. But they're all haters. They're all Nazis, according to these people. You know, they try to tear down anybody who tells the truth.
No. I think we're pretty wise to what they are. And also, let's not forget all the young men and women who died in Vietnam. Utterly useless war. Utterly worthless war. Only done for gain, money, finances, the international banking cartel, the same people who are behind all wars. And now everybody now who's dying in the Middle East, who continues to die in the Middle East, the 2 to 3 million that we killed, liquidated under the Clinton administration in Iraq, for example. How many American boys and girls have been killed with IEDs or who are brain damaged? And the number of people, and Frosty Wooldridge always brings this up, the number of young men, not quite so young anymore, who kill themselves. Suicide is like over 20 a day now. Over 20 a day
horrible.
Served in the Middle East. So look, who wins at war? The bankers win. That's it.
Okay.
That's all.
Well, yeah, but no. Yeah, I was going to say nobody wins a war. But I can't think of any war that was really necessary in my lifetime.
No.
Okay, the American War for Independence way back 200 and something years ago. Okay. Through back ages, there are so many wars, almost all fought for conquest and territory. You know, we look at Alexander the Great as a wonderful warrior, Julius Caesar, my number one hero in the whole world. Great, great guys, but they did the same thing that later on people did, like Napoleon, just conquered.
It's all about greed, property, largesse, money.
Power.
Power. It's always about power.
Power and money. Power and
but
money.
But the point is, and I watched a little documentary last night about German air technology and where they were going with their advanced jet fighters and rocket-powered this and that and ground-to-air missiles. And, one of the faults that the German leadership had was that they were trying to do too many wonder weapons at the same time.
Yeah.
And they didn't have
the
money.
They also had smart bombs.
They had smart bombs. I watched there's a video of a film, and I guess it was the Italian Navy that they were after at the early part of the war, off Crete, I think it was. Anyway, they're up in a Heinkel bomber, and they released one of these glide bombs, and it actually had a wire that stayed connected to the bomber after the glide bomb was dropped. And the guy would actually, with a joystick, he would steer it into the ship that they were aiming at. And we're talking about a couple miles of wire that would be, little thin wire that would just roll out after this thing. And he would continue to glide this bomb wherever he wanted to and take it right into that ship. Yes.
Oh, yeah. That was cutting edge. But nowadays, all our Mark 48 torpedoes on the American boats, they're all wire-guided. You've got several miles of hair-thin wire coiled up in the ass end of that torpedo. And but the Germans were ahead of everybody else. The air-to-ground smart bomb was called Fritz X. We did a feature on that in one of our magazines previous years. And but Germany, as I look through it, you know, and we're giving the history of each U-boat and each skipper who was posted to the boat, and you find these skippers, they're posted as adjutant to this outfit for 2 months. Then they're posted to another outfit for a month, then another for 2 months. They were so pitifully short of trained people. Mm-hmm. You know, they got pushed into the war. Hitler didn't, you know, the three great lies about World War II is Hitler started the war to kill all the Jews and to rule the world. Well, first off, he didn't start the war. The Polish did, because they were massacring ethnic Germans. 49,000 were massacred in the last 2 weeks of August 1939.
It was that many?
Oh, yeah, 450,000 were forcibly kicked out of Poland, because that was Germany for generations. And then after 1918, they reapportioned and said, okay, now this is Poland, because there was no Poland until 1918. It had been partitioned out by all the conquerors over the centuries. Mm-hmm. So people that had been there generations, okay, you're Germans, but now you're in Poland, so you're a Polish Volksdeutscher. 450,000 were forcibly kicked out with 20 kilos of whatever they wanted to carry. They had to leave everything else behind. We got a book on it here with all the police reports, etc. And 49,000 were murdered in the last 2 weeks of August.
That's why Hitler had to attack to stop the slaughter of ethnic Germans who were still living in the Polish side of Europe, which was created a total construct of a bunch of fat bureaucrats writing up the Treaty of Versailles. Okay, that's number one, the biggest lie. Second biggest lie.
The second one is that Hitler wanted to conquer the world. With what? He had no navy. He had a couple of battleships that were bottled up. His U-boats were primarily his whole navy, but he had no transports. He had no long-range airplanes. And the third one, to kill all the Jews. I know this is not going to set well with your listeners, but I had a good friend over there.
No, we've talked about it. I have. If you look at the Jewish reporter, David Cole, brilliant young man, great patriot, he went over there and researched the whole thing about Auschwitz. You can find the video on, well, you used to be able to. It's probably been scrubbed. But he interviewed Dr. Franziszek Piper, who was the director for 17, 18 years of the Auschwitz State Museum. And what did Dr. Piper say on videotape? He said the so-called gas chamber was constructed out of a bomb shelter by Stalin at war's end, after they overran the camp and took it, to keep the world hating the evil Nazis. It was not a gas chamber. This is the director of Auschwitz who said this on video. So what do we do with that?
When was his suicide?
I don't know how long he lived.
I had a good friend named Helmut Schmuckel, Jewish. He was a U-boat commander. There was another U-boat commander named Helmut Rosenbaum, Doesn't get much more Jewish than that. He sank a British aircraft carrier, won the Knight's Cross. I think he got the oak leaf, too. I'm not sure, though. And I've been in cemeteries in Germany that are all Jewish soldiers that died fighting for Germany. So, but you
there
have
were several hundred thousand, ladies and gentlemen, German Jews who fought for their country. Okay?
Yeah, exactly.
Facts are facts.
But you're not supposed to know those facts. You're only supposed to know the facts that have been purified. Machine gunning people in the water never happened. One of our members, Harry Oakes, really great guy. He was on one of the 327s, the big Coast Guard cutters during the war, and they had a lot of combat. And he said, yeah, they machine gunned lifeboats. After they take the survivors out of them, then they machine gun the lifeboats so they're not in, not a hazard to navigation. And sometimes the lifeboats didn't sink, and people would see lifeboats with machine gun bullet holes in and figure, aha, them Nazis did it. But yet, guys like Otto Kretschmer, Erich Topp, who were top-line German U-boat commanders, went on to become admirals with NATO. What's his name? Gerd Tater, who was like an uncle to me. He became the naval attaché, the German attaché in Canada. Now, if he was machine-gunning people in the water, they'd have sure had him hanged instead of
advancing
in the ranks of NATO.
The lies that come out of war are so, on both sides, to a degree, of course, always, but the lies on this side were particularly egregious. The other thing is, they always say, this is maybe biggest lie number four, that Hitler began bombing England. No, no, no. The British Air Force bombed Germany. In fact, they bombed, I think, Berlin, and Hitler had to respond. And the last thing that Hitler was actually dropping on England before things got completely out of hand were peace leaflets.
Right.
He
right.
wanted peace. Hundreds of thousands of them he dropped all over London, all over England, and the key cities. He wanted peace. He didn't want to fight.
He made at least 20 peace proposals, but Churchill
20.
Turned them all
wow.
down.
Well, Churchill was
not,
a drunken
you know, it was
pervert.
Not a deal where anybody takes from the other guys. Just, hey, let's put down our guns and go home.
That's it. Okay, hold on a minute. We have to pause. Harry and I will be right back. We have a lot of fun pictures to look at as we continue our walks through history together, all of us together. Next. Okay, and we're back with Harry Cooper, SharkHunters.com. If you want to join an organization that, if you like history, will give you the truth, Shark Hunters is as good as they get. Harry's books are stunning in many ways. How many out now altogether, Harry? How many books?
Number 36 just went into publishing a couple days ago.
Very good.
And we got
and
about four
one.
More ready to drop in the next month and a half.
Wow. I'm just amazed. The big one is, of course, Hitler in Argentina, which really blew the lid off the big lie that Hitler died in the bunker and so forth. And we've been through the story many, many times.
Mm-hmm.
But I hope all of you who are really interested in history get that book and others, but get that book and read it. You may lose friends if you try to tell them the truth because they've been brainwashed their entire lives. But it's just like the... The coronavirus, it hasn't been isolated. It doesn't exist. They can't prove it's a causal agent for anything. And yet they continue to put this fake, unproven, deadly vaccine, I call it the kill shot, out, and they're forcing it into people, basically, or they'll be fired from their jobs, and they're using all kinds of tricks. This is a real horror. It's a similar kind of a thing. Lies are lies and lies are lies, and we have to stop them. And the only way to stop them is with truth. And that's what Shark Hunters does such a wonderful job with. So congratulations, sir.
Thank you.
Nobody else on the planet doing what you do. Not like, and those things on television you see, hunting Hitler and all of that, most of it is certainly in certain key ways stolen from Harry's work, his research, his books. No credit given, of course, but that's the way
it is
in this world. Not a penny. not a Reichsmark. Nothing.
Hey, okay. At least I can look at the guy in the mirror when I'm shaving and not have to look away in shame.
Isn't that the truth? Yes, indeed. Now, your next planned trip to Argentina, is that still on the schedule at this moment?
Yeah, both our tours are October will be two weeks in Germany and Austria, in southern Germany, Bavaria, and Austria. And then in November, 2 weeks in Argentina. And I just heard from Martin about 5-6 hours ago. He's all set. We're going to have a great time. Like last time when we were there in 2019, and among other things, we spent one night on the estate where Hitler lived from 45 until 1955, and couldn't stay in the main house because there was no heat, no plumbing, no
Well, hell,
toilets.
There's a fireplace there.
Yeah, I know. There's a fireplace. But the guest house, which is only about 40 yards away, 50 yards, it had running water. It had hot water for showers. We could shave. We could brush our teeth. But it was heated by a big fireplace, too. And it was nice. You know, you close your eyes and let your mind wander back into history.
Right. Well, there's a lot more potential going on there as well. Harry will be looking into, which we're not going to talk about on the air, but if you've ever wanted to go on a trip of discovery, this is probably the one.
Yeah, you're walking in the footsteps of history.
Exactly. We could, a lot to talk about. September, and then Argentina is October, you said?
I misspoke. October is southern Germany and Austria. November is Argentina. Because springtime in Argentina.
That's right.
Beautiful weather down there. It's pretty much like Florida. It's like Florida's fall.
Uh-huh. All right. Martin told me, I'm sure he's told you the same thing, that unfortunately, more and more people are taking boats or driving and going on to the private estate where Hitler lived for 10 years. And if you think about it, he lived there maybe longer than any other place he lived in as an adult. How's that? That's very strange when you think about it. But they've just got to come up with a way to take charge of that situation.
Yeah,
and have
armed
somebody
guards.
On the, an arm, absolutely, and at least two armed guards. Make a deal with them. They can stay
with
there for
dogs.
Free. With whatever. They've got to do this. It's got to stop. It's got to stop.
Big dogs. Yeah, because not so much vandalism going on yet, although that could happen. But it's just people trashing and tromping all over the place, and especially the new road that went through. It's quite a ways from the manor house and the guest houses, but half a mile up the road, the road goes literally right up alongside the buildings that were the farm. Literally, I mean, you get off the road, you stop your car on the road, get off, walk 5 feet, and there's the gate to get into the farm. And nobody, like I say, so far, thank God, nobody has done any vandalizing. But, you know, you can't have people just tromping around like that.
No, and they are. They're fortunately, the place, in terms of things that can be looted, has been pretty well taken care of now. They can't loot anymore or vandalize and destroy things. There were some people who got into that house who have a lot of hate in them, and they did some damage to things in the house. That's been taken care of, and we're happy to say that that part of it is not really an issue much anymore. So
right. And so far, but you know, hey, let's face it. It's out in the middle of nowhere. Some jackass can come along and set the place on fire, and there ain't no such thing as a fire department out there. And that would be tragic. It's history. Whether you like Hitler or hate him, or you like the Germans or hate him, it doesn't matter. It's history. Unlike the cancel culture here that's tearing down all our statues. I just heard my old hometown, Chicago, there's 41 statues being slated for demolishing or moving, whatever. George Washington, Abe Lincoln, Ulysses Grant, Teddy Roosevelt, who else? Oh, Columbus, naturally. Columbus, terrible guy.
If they're white, they're coming down. So that's the bigger message. It's the communist cancel culture. Let's be honest about it. That's what
it is. And they're averaging right now, they're averaging two people a day shot dead in Chicago and about two dozen a day wounded. My old hometown. Sure glad I don't live there anymore. Bad enough they're freezing their fannies off and horrible, horrible snow. But if you're able to get out, you got a chance of getting shot dead.
All true. Okay, let's go to guests and pull up photos. Don't look ahead now. There's a gallery there, but make sure you kind of follow along with us. All right. Photo number one in the photo section, oddly enough.
Photo one is the first photo.
Yes.
I'm not as dumb as I look.
No.
This all looks disjointed, but as we get through it, you'll find how it's all tied together, and it starts out with how I got involved in the history of the U-boats. Well, there's way back into history.
Very good.
Photo number one, and I was driving short track in Chicago at a place called O'Hare Stadium, which doesn't exist anymore. It's a high-rise apartment. No, not apartment, business complex. It's offices. And you can see how my car is somewhat dented up.
Is that a 57 Chevy or a 1934 Fisher-Price?
No, it's a 57 Chevy. It started out as a 55 that a guy named Marshall Teague drove on the beach course down at Daytona. And then it was bought by some guys up in Chicago, and they ran it as a late model. Then they reskinned it to a 57. Another guy had it. He couldn't get out of his own shadow, and I bought it. And I had never driven a stock car before, and it was fun. I got the nickname Dirty Harry, and it was 4 years before the movie Dirty Harry ever came out, because I figured if I was coming and you didn't see me coming and didn't get out of the way, I would just move you the hard way. And my last race there was in 1968, and I was so far ahead in the point standings that I blew an engine 9 races before the end of the year, and I still finished up in second place. Blew the engine, and I had no money. I still have no money, and I couldn't replace the engine. And it was so much fun because you were going 70, 80 miles an hour, and you could push and shove, and these cars are well built. Nobody ever got hurt. And but the money was pitiful. I think for a win like that, you see me there, I think I got $25 for it. Doesn't even pay for your gasoline.
It looks like you have a mustache there. Is that a mustache?
Of course. That was back when mustaches and long hair was cool. Before your time, Rents.
I'll ignore that. I brought them back. They're back in style now.
Oh, okay. Well, when you see the next one. Now, this was short tracking, and I knew some of the guys who were running the super speedways, and I don't know if it's legal or not, but the statute of limitations has run out. I was an executive with a firm in Chicago, and I was in charge of letting out contracts mm-hmm. for warehousing, et cetera, so, and traffic. And so this one guy who owned several super speedway cars came by because he owned a trucking company, and he wanted me to throw some trucking his way, and I knew him. And I told him I was pretty happy with the trucking firms that we were using, and he showed me his one car that he had for sale, race car. It was one of those 69 Charger Daytonas with the long Snoopy front end and a big wing on the back. And he told me how much he wanted. I said, I don't have anywhere near that kind of money. And he said, well, if you throw some trucking my way, I'll cut the price in half. I'll give it to you for half price. I said, well, yeah, but I don't have that kind of money either. So that evening, I was having dinner with two guys that had a big warehouse outside of Chicago.
Yeah.
And they were one of the final three I was looking at to give a $250,000 a year contract. Now, this was back in the early 70s, and that was a lot of money. So there were two guys, and their names, honest to God, was Tom and Jerry. Tom was the old hand. Jerry was the young fireball, and we're talking, and they're trying to convince me. And I was pretty sure I was probably going to go with them anyhow. And we got to talking about the race cars, and I told him it was a damn expensive hobby. And Tom is just slurping his soup, and Jerry says, hey, maybe we could sponsor your race car. And I said, that would be nice. Tom's still slurping his soup. And Jerry said, well, how much would it cost? And I told him, it's a pretty big number for those cars. And he looked kind of stunned. Tom never stopped slurping his soup. He just said, write him a check, Jerry. And Jerry stopped and looked at him, and Tom paused halfway between slurping. He says, you heard me, Jerry. Write him a check. So he wrote me a check with a lot of numbers on it. And he says, how's our contract look now? I said, I think it just got signed. Stop by in the morning and pick it up. So that's how I was able to make the jump up to, you click on photo number two. And that was my car. We took the nose off and the wing off because, you know, it had to be reskinned. And if you look close, yeah, there's a mustache. And look
I
at
do,
that.
I see it.
Look at that English sheepdog hairdo and the Velcro sideburns. And
and the same number 17 on the door.
Yeah, right. Every car I ever owned was number 17. And yeah. And I think part of the reason was the guy I bought my 57 Chevy from, mm-hmm. he had number 17. And so the first night I had it out, and I had never driven on an oval track before, I qualified a tenth of a second faster than his best time in 4 years that he's had the car. So I just thought I would do my best to make number 17 a little more memorable. And people are wondering, what the hell's this got to do with U-boats? Oh, hang on, folks. We're getting there. And this was at the 1974 Twin 200 at Michigan International Speedway. And if you hop over to number three, this was the 1976 Texas 500. And we're doing about 180 miles an hour there, and I'm passing the number 19 car. And it wasn't many laps after this, I blew the engine in my race car. And heading back home to Chicago, I blew the engine in my truck. I was a really good race car driver. I was not a very good engine builder.
Remind me to loan you my car sometime.
Yeah, right. I was not a very good engine builder. And when I got back to my office, my boss had quit. And another corporate executive that I couldn't get along with for a year, he was suddenly my boss. So I just quit, sold everything I owned, built a 30-foot sailing yacht. There was an outfit called Luger Boats. They were advertising in all sorts of magazines back then. You bought a boat in kit form. It was like building a model boat, only it was one-to-one size. And so I flew up to Minneapolis, where their headquarters was, and talked them into a deal They sold me everything I needed, the boat, the kit, everything for 10 grand. It usually was about 30. But I promised I would write at least one article about them after I built the boat. Well, as it turned out, I wrote a whole bunch of articles about it. And when I sailed into some exotic port, you know, as we're coming here into the beautiful port of Wambambula in my Luger Voyager 30, so it took me, most people, it said, they said it takes about 3 years to build one of them boats. I built it in 2.5 months because I was working on it 8, 9, 10 hours a day.
I understand. Well, you're goal-oriented like I am. You want it done, and there's no one else going to do it better than you, so you do it.
Right, and my good friend John Watts owned the marina, and he'd let me build it there on his marina. And I'd come in early in the morning, have coffee with him and all his workers, and then I'd start working on my boat. And then a couple hours later, hey, Cooper, we're going on break. You're going, no, I ain't going. I got to keep doing this. Didn't take a lunch. 2.5 months later, I was ready to go. Okay, let's face it. This was the 70s. I was a bachelor. I was young, good looking, had a lot of money. So I put an ad in Cruising World magazine for female crew companion to go to the Bahamas. And I got over 200 replies. And there you look on photo number 4. There was my crew. Got over 200 replies, whittled it down. And
extraordinary. It was an intellectual relationship, of course, between and crew.
Of course. And, Lynette had worked for her father's printing shop, but her hobby, she was a motorcycle racer. Debbie was a nurse supervisor of a clinic in Ohio or California, I can't remember which. And Karen was a realtor. So we set out from Chicago. I had never sailed before. I built this thing. I had never sailed before. I took it on the motor out into Pistakey Lake, which is outside Chicago, got in the middle of the lake, shut off the motor, hoisted the sails, and started pulling on this rope and that rope line, and learned a little bit about it. So we went from the north branch of the Chicago River down to the Chicago Ship and Sanitary Canal, to the Des Plaines River, to the Fox River, to the Illinois River, to the upper Mississippi, to the lower Mississippi, and sailed across the Gulf, and then through the state of Florida on the Okeechobee Waterway, and down to the Keys, where we stayed in the Keys for several months, and then over to the Bahamas. And it was an awesome time. And the greatest thing, well, with the girls, they were all good cooks. But the best thing about it, I stayed 8 years on my boat in the islands. And the best thing was there's no stress. You don't have to get all put on fancy clothes. You don't have to fight your way down the interstate. You don't have to fight with customers, et cetera, et cetera. I'd always get up early anyhow, and I'd be sitting in the cockpit with a hot mug of tea in my hand, watching the sun come up behind the palm trees. And I'm thinking, do I want to run on the beach? Do I want to go swimming? Do I want another cup of tea? Oh, to heck with it. Put the decision off till later. And there's an island over there a mile away. We got to go to that island tomorrow, next week, next month. Stress will kill you, and you have no stress. And I started writing for the boating magazines there. And then the owner of the Nassau Tribune, a really, really fine gentleman, Sir Etienne Depew, and I became friends, and I was writing articles for the Nassau Tribune while we were bouncing around in the islands. And it was just an incredibly peaceful time. The water was like your bathtub, clear as glass. So what's not to like? And like I say, the girls were good cooks. They did all sorts of stuff on a two-burner stove. If you look at photo 5, that's my boat, retired racer.
The now, let me ask you a quick question about the boat before wander off into another area of this remarkable story, which we're getting through.
We're getting close to the U-boat angle.
Yeah, the boat you built, it came in a kit, so you had a keel. Was it a one piece keel? How did it work? Was it fiberglass at all, or was it all wood?
No, it's glass. The whole hull came together, but then there were no windows in it.
I see.
You had to cut them in, and you had to build all the interior, the bulkheads, the seats, the benches, the bunks, everything. You had to build all of that and fiberglass it in, and they were all pre-cut. It was like putting together a jigsaw puzzle where you had the guides on which piece goes where. And then you just had to fiberglass it together, and I had to put in, I think, 3,000 or maybe it was 4,000 pounds of ballast. So I put in concrete down in the keel cavity. Uh-huh. It drew 3 feet, and it had bunks for 6 people.
Huh.
So it wasn't
you learned
long
on the
and,
job. You learned on again? The job. You learned how to sail on the job after building your own boat. That's
and,
amazing.
And fortunately, Debbie was an experienced sailor, so she took that over. And it was a good thing because the first and only time I've ever been seasick, we were getting ready to leave from Key Largo, and we were on the bay side where it's flat calm. And we were going to have a big celebration. By now, Lynette had already gone back, and it was only Karen and Debbie. And so we got steaks and everything from the local supermarket. We got so much packaged food, the boat went down 4 inches on its water line, and we had it all packed away so they could cook it. Everything, boxes and cans. But we had the fresh steaks. We each had a great big steak with baked potatoes and butter. I ate my whole steak. Each one of them only ate half of their steak, so I ate the other half of their steak. Yeah, you can see where this is going. So
and
to be ready to leave.
Going into the feed the fishes was going.
Yeah, you betcha. Almost. But so just before dark, we went with the motor around to the ocean side of Key Largo. And even though there was a reef, we still had a little bit of a roll. Oh, jeez. I was turning green. And we had to leave at about 11 o'clock at night. And you sailed directly east, 090 by the compass. Well, with a sailboat, we were going 0-100 because of the northbound drift of the Gulf Stream. And by dawn, the sun would be coming up behind Bimini, Cat Key, and Gun Key. I couldn't move, Jesus. So Debbie was at the helm, and I told Karen, keep a lookout. If you see a red and green light with a white light in the middle, let us know fast because that's a freighter coming our way. And I went and laid down on the sofa. I just, oh, God, I was in terrible shape. And finally, about 2 in the morning, I guess, Karen came below, and she says, you better get straight because Debbie's falling asleep up here. Okay, so I came topside. And by then, we were well offshore, and we had a good, strong wind and the spray in my face, and I could see the horizon, and I got my head straight after a while. And so we made it over there to Cat Key and Gun Key, and it's just awesome. Yeah. I had such a wonderful time.
8 years.
And the people over 8 years. And the people in the out islands, I don't know how it is today, but back then you get to these little tiny villages. It's like your family. We sailed into Little Farmer's Key.
All right, what? Hold on, Harry. Let me pause you right there, and we'll pick it up at Farmer's Key when we come back.